Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tortoise. Hello, it's Claudia here, and you're listening to the Slow Newscast from Tortoise. This week, we're bringing you a three-part series. In The State of Netanyahu, reporter Donald McIntyre tells the story of Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, from 1993 to now. This is Episode 1, Mr. Right.
Crowds have gathered on the lawn.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mrs. Clinton and Mrs. Rabin.
Welcome to this great occasion of history and hope. Today, we bear witness to an extraordinary act in one of history's defining dramas.
The Israeli Prime Minister and the Palestinian leader walk out of the White House and stand flanking the U.S. President.
The land has been so drenched in warfare and hatred, the conflicting claims of history etched so deeply in the souls of the combatants there, that many believe the past would always have the upper hand.
They look cheerful and relaxed, but just an hour earlier, the Israeli Prime Minister, Yitzhak Rabin, had been stressed. Bill Clinton had dropped the bombshell that he'd have to shake hands with his long-term adversary, Yasser Arafat, in front of the world's media. By all accounts, the blood drains from his face. Then the Israeli leader pulls himself together and says, okay, but no kissing. The handshake symbolizes the ratification of the Oslo Accords, reached after months and months of secret negotiations. It brings to a final close the first Palestinian uprising, or Intifada, which had begun 6 years earlier. Bill Clinton's triumphant. Yitzhak Rabin takes his turn at the lectern.
We have come from an anguished and grieving land. We have come to try and put an end to the hostilities so that our children, our children's children, will no longer experience the painful of cost of war, violence and terror.
Finally, the Palestinian leader steps up, dressed in military uniform with a black and white keffiyeh draped over his head and shoulders.
My people are hoping that this agreement, which we are signing today, will usher in an age of peace, coexistence, and equal rights.
Even though it doesn't specifically mention a Palestinian state, this accord opens the path to a peace negotiation over the next 5 years. Seeing it through will require commitment and goodwill from both sides. Even so, for most Palestinians and more than half the Israeli public, this feels like a momentous breakthrough, a moment of great optimism. But not everyone feels optimistic. The leader of Israel's main opposition, Likud Party, doesn't. Benjamin Netanyahu, Bibi as he's known in Israel, has been a staunch opponent of a Palestinian state ever since he was in the public sphere, which is a very long time. It's frankly hard to think of many politicians who've done more to shape their country's image of itself and in the world than Benjamin Netanyahu. For the best part of two decades, I've reported on and tried to explain the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I wrote a book about Gaza in the process. But in all my time covering politics of one kind or another, I've never come across anyone quite like Benjamin Netanyahu, with his capacity at once to define and divide his country. What I'm really trying to find out here is not so much who Netanyahu is, but why. Why has he taken Israel to war from what was a path towards peace? Why has he managed to last so long as Israel's leader? Why has he put at risk Israel's relationship with its closest allies, including the United States, and its potential partners for peace? Netanyahu was born in Israel, but grew up in the United States. In 1978, he appeared on TV there as a terrorism expert and an opponent of a Palestinian state.
Look, I'm 28 years old. I've had to defend my country in two wars and in many battles. Nobody wants peace more than Israel. But the stumbling block to the road for peace is this demand for a PLO state, which will mean more war, which will mean more violence in the Middle East. And I think, I sincerely believe, if this demand is abandoned, we can have real and genuine peace.
And now, in 1993, aged 43, his views haven't changed much. Actually, the Oslo peace deals come as a bit of a surprise. Like the rest of the world, he had no idea this whole thing was being cooked up between Palestinian and Israeli negotiators in secret meetings in Norway. Netanyahu only found out about it when it was publicly announced. From where he's standing, at the headquarters of the opposition Likud party in Jerusalem, the Oslo Accords look like, he says, a foolhardy and dangerous risk. In interviews at the time, he even compares them to Neville Chamberlain's infamous Munich Agreement with Hitler.
I think in the world there are two types of peace. The peace of democracies, which require no strength and no deterrence, and no armies, and no territories, and no land barriers, because democracies, by their nature, tend to peace. But there's another kind of peace, and that's the peace of deterrence, the peace opposite dictatorships, where the only thing that keeps the peace is the inability of the dictatorships or the despotisms to go to war. I think in this century, the greatest tragedies occurred when the democracies failed to distinguish one type of peace from another. Towards Nazi Germany, they practiced appeasement, the peace of democracies, and they got war.
Netanyahu has this filter through which he sees Israel's relations with the Palestinian population. Where has it come from? In his childhood home, the patriarch ruled. Benzion Netanyahu was an academic historian, a secular man who was deeply influenced by right-wing Zionism. Benzion scorned what he saw as naive ideas about the Arabs, believing instead in a strong military approach to protecting the promised land. And the young Bibi was shaped by his father. For him, the idea of negotiations and compromise was like opening a chink in the armor. It left you vulnerable. But for more progressive Israelis, like prominent lawyer Talia Sasson, there is no real option other than the kind of compromise set out in Oslo.
When I ignore the interest of the Palestinian for a moment, from our point of view, and our interest is Israel won't be the homeland of the Jewish people and a democratic state. It can't be a democratic state with 3 million Palestinians without any citizenship in between us, without no borders. And if we keep this situation, we might lose the legitimacy of being the homeland of the Jewish people.
So there's a lot at stake with the Oslo Accords. In the end, the violence that first rocks the peace process doesn't start with the Palestinians, as Netanyahu suggested it might. One Friday morning at 5 a.m., just a few months after that press conference on the White House lawn, an American settler dressed in an Israeli military uniform goes to the main mosque in the Palestinian city of Hebron, where more than 800 people have gathered for morning prayers. He opens fire with an automatic weapon, killing 29 Palestinians. Protests break out around the West Bank and the Israeli forces shoot people dead. Hamas responds with a spate of suicide bombings. The militant group was opposed to the Oslo Accords too. As things deteriorate, Israel's opposition leader is there, taking every opportunity to say, "I told you so."
Netanyahu ran a very, very aggressive campaign against Yitzhak Rabin and against the Oslo Accord and said, "Look what it is leading us to."
When Hamas mounts a series of attacks to oppose Oslo, Netanyahu raises his profile and poll ratings higher by rushing to the scenes where suicide bombers have blown themselves up along with their Israeli victims. Aviv Bushinsky was a journalist at the time, but he'd go on to join Netanyahu's team as a spokesman.
Netanyahu was criticized for deliberately going to all the horrific scenes.
The stench of death is everywhere. I know it's a difficult time for the people of Israel. I've called for restraint, for people to contain their emotions, which must be...
You saw Netanyahu, the politician, stands there, and they said he's dancing on the blood of the victims.
I think what we have here is a mistaken conception on the part of the government in believing that Yasser Arafat would fight the Hamas and other terrorists to protect Jewish lives. I think that Mr. Rabin bears a very grave responsibility indeed.
But Netanyahu enjoyed huge support because people say, okay, we wanted peace with the Palestinians and we received terror.
Plenty of Israelis feel like Netanyahu does. The slogan, "This peace is killing us," begins to gain popularity among the deal's opponents. The anti-Oslo protests around the country culminate in a huge demonstration. Tens of thousands of Israelis cram into the center of Jerusalem.
It was a very, very crowded demonstration of more than 100,000 people.
Ehud Olmert was Israel's prime minister from 2006 to 2009. But back then, in the 90s, he was the mayor of Jerusalem.
And I was supposed to speak. In the balcony where I was, on the other side, I saw "Death to the Arabs." I said, "I'm not going to speak here. I'm sorry. I'm not going to speak." People say to me, "It will send a very bad message. If you don't speak, you have to speak. You are the mayor," and so on and so forth. So I started by saying, "I don't agree with this slogan. We are not, calling for the death of the Arabs." So they all booed me when they had pictures of Rabin dressed with the SS uniforms. Decent people were not part of it. We saw the incitements. We saw the violent attitude, and we didn't want to be part of it.
And Netanyahu did. I mean, he did go to several of those demonstrations.
What do you mean he did go? He organized it. He sponsored it. He helped finance it. This was his doing. This was his campaign.
Netanyahu's party claims Rabin is no longer the tough general who commanded troops in Israel's defining wars of 1948 and 1967, but a man who's abandoned the basic elements of Zionism.
He stood on the stage in Jerusalem when the people shouted, "Kill Rabin, kill Rabin."
Israeli lawyer Talia Sasson says Netanyahu used those protests and did nothing to dampen the increasingly violent undertone.
He continued to stay there and to speak to the people. You know, other people left the stage. He didn't. And then he was a part of a demonstration when they took, you know, a coffin written there, "Rabin is killing Zionism." He marched in the street in front of it.
One of those who took part in the demonstrations was a young ultra-extremist called Itamar Ben-Gvir. He brandished an emblem from Rabin's prime ministerial Cadillac, telling a TV crew, "We've got to his car and we'll get to him." He'll end up being an important part of Netanyahu's story, three decades later, he'll appoint Ben-Gvir as his national security minister. There are big counter-demonstrations too, calling for continued dialogue and peace talks. The Prime Minister, Yitzhak Rabin, is there at many of them. It's the evening of November the 4th, 1995, and Rabin's on stage talking about peace. There are songs, and the atmosphere's hopeful as the crowd sways along. As Rabin steps off the stage and starts making his way through the throng, a right-wing fanatic, Yigal Amir's waiting for him. He shoots Rabin at close range, three times in the back. Yitzhak Rabin dies, and with him, what many believe was the closest Israel ever got to making peace with the Palestinians.
The Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, the architect of the Middle East peace process, has been assassinated.
Truly shocking news from the Middle East tonight. Israel's Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin has been assassinated.
The evening spent dreaming of peace turns into a national nightmare.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
That's a sort of freedom, like an intrinsic knowledge, like you are part ocean, ocean is part you. You have salt water in your body. You are part of this.
Oceans, life underwater. A new podcast all about the oceans and the mind-blowing life within them.
Subscribe now to Oceans, Life Underwater on your favorite podcast app.
Hello, it's Tomini from Tortoise. This podcast is sponsored by EY. Senior business leaders in the UK are keen to harness AI, but there's a complex regulatory maze emerging globally. The OECD, a group of the world's richest countries, which includes the UK, has adopted a new set of principles to ensure that AI operates in a way that's safe, fair, and trustworthy. The principles are wide-ranging, but in essence, call for AI systems to be designed in a way that respects the rule of law and human rights, and says there should be transparency around their use. By embracing the core principles of responsible innovation, UK business leaders can better explore sector-specific opportunities and emerging trends without compromising on citizens' trust. Find out more at ey.ai.
After his death, a bloodstained, crumpled papers found in his jacket. It contains the lyrics of the famous Hebrew song, Shir Yashalom, Song for Peace, what Rabin had been singing with the crowds minutes before he was killed. Outside the hospital, where Rabin's body is taken, Israelis gather, holding banners, saying things like, Bibi, Rabin's blood is on your hands. Bibi's a murderer, they chant. Lots of people still hold him responsible for stoking the anger that led to Rabin's assassination. People like lawyer Talia Sasson.
Of course he's responsible for that. Just to remind you, his incitement against Rabin before the assassination, because he gave justification on that time to the public of Israel, that Rabin is risking the state of Israel and he opposed him, and he said a lot of things against him in a way that are not acceptable.
Others think it's unfair to blame Netanyahu.
I think that ultimately you have to ask yourself what his role was. His role was the leader of the opposition. His role wasn't to be a cheerleader.
for Rabin. His role was to try and replace Rabin.
His biographer, Anshul Pfeffer.
And as far as Oslo goes, half of the Israeli public were against. Now, the question is, did he rein in the more extreme parts of the opposition? No. Was that his job? Well, they weren't his party members. In hindsight, he could have done more. He should have done more. But I think that putting Netanyahu in the role of the man who somehow contributed to the assassination, to the atmosphere around the assassination itself, I think that's unjust.
But within hours after her husband's funeral, Rabin's widow goes on television and points her finger very clearly at Netanyahu.
Netanyahu and said, you must stop this incitement. Yeah. To what extent do you blame Mr. Netanyahu and the Likud for what has happened?
I do blame them. The rally in Kikar Zion in Jerusalem that showed him in the uniform of a Nazi. So Mr. Bibi Netanyahu, now he can say from here to eternity that he didn't support it and didn't agree with it, but he was there and he didn't stop it.
Netanyahu was in shock. And I'm not talking about emotional, that the Prime Minister of Israel is being assassinated, but I'm talking politics. He thought that it's the end of his career.
His former advisor, Aviv Brushinsky. He says before the assassination, everyone thought Bibi had the upcoming election all sewn up.
Netanyahu was leading by far in the polls. And when Rabin was assassinated, and the coin started to flip, and they said, it's all because of Netanyahu's incitement. And Netanyahu is the one who killed the peace dream.
He fears the assassinations robbed him of the chance to beat Rabin fair and square in the coming election. He's convinced he would have exposed Rabin as a failure rather than the hero he's now being hailed as. Shimon Peres, the foreign minister, takes over Rabin's post as prime minister and ushers the country into a general election. It looks like Peres will beat Netanyahu, riding on a wave of national grief. But after the mourning is over and bolstered by a fresh wave of suicide bombings, Netanyahu recovers his momentum.
He is a great performer, a much greater performer than Laurence Olivier.
Former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert again.
Every speech that Bibi makes, he rehearses. He once came to me and he said to me, you know, you must stand in front of the mirror when you prepare for a speech, and speak to the mirror and make the movements of your, you know, and move your hands and so on and so forth. It will give you a much stronger, you know, feeling about what you're going to say, and that will make you a much greater speaker.
The exit polls are showing Peres in the lead, but then the numbers begin to turn.
They went to sleep thinking that Peres won the elections, and they woke up in the morning realizing that Netanyahu won the elections, and it all changed in one night. And Netanyahu won the elections only for, I think, a difference of 1,200 votes.
If Peres had won, would he have done more to take the Oslo Accords forward? We're in counterfactual territory here, of course. Peres spoke of peace. But even if he'd won the election, I'm not convinced he could have picked up where Rabin left off. He lacked the authority and military record that could have helped his predecessor see it through. Peres was also intimidated by the propaganda of his right-wing opponents. At this point, a small majority of Israelis are still in favour of some kind of dialogue with the Palestinians. But as the violence continues, Benjamin Netanyahu's there to capitalise on it, and his hardline politics start to look more and more attractive to lots of Israelis. Campaigning's one thing, running the country's another. The new Prime Minister feels he has to do the minimum required to abide by the Oslo Accords. He has no love for the peace process, but the US President Bill Clinton's exerting immense pressure on him. Eventually he relents and agrees to meet Yasser Arafat, the man he's always called a terrorist. At the Erez crossing into the Gaza Strip, the two men lean across a table and shake hands as the cameras click. Ahmed Khalidi is a former Palestinian negotiator.
He did proceed with implementing, in part, some of the Oslo deals, including some of the deals that Peres didn't, specifically relating to Hebron.
A big part of the Oslo deal was the promise that cities in the West Bank would be handed over to be administered by the Palestinians. Nablus, Ramallah, Jenin. Hebron is one of the last. The problem with that city is that there's a settlement of hard-right Israelis living right in the heart of it.
Now, part of what he did in Hebron was that he divided it up in such a way that the settlers remained, and they still today, flourishing right in the heart of Hebron.
You're going to hear a lot about Israeli settlements in this series, so I'd like to give you an idea of what they look like. But it's not easy. There are lots of different kinds of settlement. A settlement in its earliest iteration is just a bunch of tents or prefabricated buildings that have been plonked on a West Bank hillside and the land claimed by Jews. But some settlements that have been there a long time are so developed they look just like any other town or city, but with a lot more security. The Hebron settlement, the one Netanyahu's made sure remains, is unique. It's right in the heart of the city, and it's surrounded by barbed wire and fences and guarded by the Israeli army. These settlers are some of the most hardline nationalists in the country. Incidentally, Itamar Ben-Gvir, the man who'd proudly brandished the emblem he'd stolen from Rabin's car, is a Hebron settler. And remember the Jewish terrorist who'd opened fire on the mosque, killing so many Palestinians? For many years, Ben-Gvir had a portrait of him on his wall at home. Back then, the hard right in Israel was furious that Netanyahu had handed most of the city back to the Palestinians. The Hebron Agreement also led directly to an investigation of corruption against Netanyahu. The accusation he was facing is a little bit complex, so bear with me. The PM needed votes to get his Hebron deal passed by the Knesset. The allegation was that he tried to buy the votes of a smaller far-right party. Its leader was facing corruption charges, and Netanyahu apparently tried to appoint an attorney general who would potentially drop the charges.
This was, in my opinion, the most important investigation ever was done against Bibi Netanyahu, and my opinion...
Talia Sasson was the government prosecutor who handled the case against Netanyahu. She says her boss refused to allow it to go ahead.
Yeah. The discussion was if there were enough evidence. In my opinion, with another two colleagues of mine, very senior colleagues, we were the three of us, that there are enough evidence.
Had the prosecution proceeded, Netanyahu's whole political career would have been stillborn early in his first term as prime minister. It could have changed the history of Israel. He's escaped any charges this time, but it's a sign of things to come. Years later, his leadership will be mired in more allegations of corruption, allegations which he's always vehemently denied. The Hebron deal passes, but it isn't enough. The pressure from Clinton to advance the Oslo Accords he brokered is unrelenting. Around 75% of Israelis are in favour of moving forward with Oslo in some way, and although he doesn't like it one bit, Netanyahu feels he doesn't have a choice. In rural Maryland, Israelis and Palestinians sign a new memorandum, Y River. This fresh deal promises a fraction of what the Palestinians believed Oslo was offering. Even with this far more watered-down compromise, Netanyahu knows the hardliners are going to be furious, and so he does what he always does when his hand is forced. He stalls, playing for time.
it was clear to the Clinton administration that he was sort of stonewalling.
Khaled Al-Gindi used to be an advisor to the Palestinian leadership and took part in negotiations with Israel. He's now a senior fellow on Palestinian affairs at the Middle East Institute.
He was very reluctant to move ahead, renegotiating what was supposed to be another redeployment from the West Bank, and it ended up being sort of a compromise of a compromise.
I am pleased to welcome Prime Minister Netanyahu, Chairman Arafat, and their delegations. For 17 months, the Middle East peace process has been stalled. This week's talk at Y River offered the chance for the parties to break the logjam.
Well, for a start, he never wanted to make those concessions. Those concessions were wrung out of him by Bill Clinton over months of pressure.
Netanyahu biographer Anshul Pfeffer again.
And the Y Plantation agreement was something that for days and days, when they were there in America, Bill Clinton was heavily leaning on him to agree to them. So we have to give Clinton a lot of credit.
But publicly, Netanyahu plays his role, sounding an almost dovish note.
Today's a day when Israel and our entire region are more secure. Now, this has required sacrifice from both sides.
Though it's so limited in scope, the Y River Agreement still outrages some on the right who feel it's making too many territorial concessions.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's first real public test since the long-awaited breakthrough in the peace process. Jewish extremists have condemned him for his deal with the Palestinians. Some say he's upset this clique of Israelis as much as Yitzhak Rabin did. Netanyahu should watch out for the consequences.
What's going on? We fought 50 years for independence to have such a shame like this? And from whom? From the Prime Minister of the national government? That we had so many expectations. It's a very sad day. It's a very black day.
Netanyahu's trying to cover his bases. He's trying not to alienate the Americans, but he's also stalling and avoiding following through so he doesn't antagonize those on the right. He uses excuse after excuse to avoid transferring territory to the Palestinians' control.
An outcome of the final settlement that should be negotiated and peacefully negotiated. But we can only move forward on negotiations for peace and an implementation of peace that is pursued peacefully by the Palestinians.
Like the Americans, the center-left, led by Ehud Barak, is frustrated by Netanyahu dragging his feet. But the hard right's annoyed, too, that he signed a deal to advance Oslo in the first place. In December 1998, he seeks to pacify his own right-wingers by suspending the Y River deal. He uses some confrontations between Palestinians and Israeli troops as his reason. The Americans are furious.
It was made known by the Clinton administration that the reason it wasn't being implemented was Israel, and Netanyahu in particular.
Khaled Al-Gindi again.
But it was a personal grievance that the administration had with Netanyahu himself. And that translated into a pretty clear effort by the Clinton administration. They made it clear that they did not want to see him reelected. And if there was going to be an election in Israel, they wanted to see him replaced.
Just a few months later, the hardliners in Netanyahu's own party say they've lost confidence in him and they force a general election. It's not going to go his way. If Netanyahu thought he could somehow play everyone, the Americans, Israeli supporters of Oslo, and the hard right, he was wrong. In the end, it's angered them all. While to his left, the opposition leader, Ehud Barak's popularity has grown, Netanyahu's own political position has been weakened by the hemorrhaging of support to his right. On election night, Ehud Barak and the Labour Party beat him by a wide margin.
Landslide, Belaz, shall
In voting against Netanyahu and for Barak, the Israeli public has chosen to follow through with the peace process. At this point, Aviv Bushinsky's working for Netanyahu. He remembers what a blow it was, and he says the result taught him a very important lesson.
And I think that when Netanyahu lost in 99, because he lost the support of the right-wingers, but the extreme right-wingers, he understood since then that you don't mess with the right-wingers. And that's how Netanyahu keeps in an adamant way his relationship with the right-wingers.
It's a lesson he'll never forget. The hard right is where he feels most comfortable, but now he also realizes his political future depends on them. Following Likud's defeat, Netanyahu steps down as leader. The guy who takes over as opposition leader is a military man who fought in 1948 in the war which cemented Israel's status as a nation. For Ariel Sharon, Jerusalem is a city that belongs to the Jewish people.
It's a normal thing to visit the Temple Mount, and every Jew can visit Temple Mount exactly as every Arab can visit any other place in the country.
In September 2000, around a year after he took over as head of the opposition, Sharon walks through the old city with his security detail. He walks up to the compound of Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock, one of the holiest sites in the world for Muslims. For Jews, it's also sacred. It's the Temple Mount, where successive historical Jewish temples stood, the holiest site in Judaism.
Though all of us would like to have peace, all of us are committed to peace, I cannot see any possibility for a real peace if Jews were not allowed to go to the holiest place that belonged to them.
The visit to the mosque compound is seen by Palestinians as a deliberate provocation. The event marks the beginning of the second Palestinian Intifada, or uprising. The violence will last for more than 4 years. There are almost daily clashes and suicide bombings. But it doesn't stop Sharon taking Likud to election victory the following year in the midst of an armed conflict. 4 years into his premiership, Sharon does something that will have an indelible effect on the story of Israel and the Palestinians. He decides to pull the Israeli military and civilians out of Gaza. At the time, around 8,000 Jewish settlers were living in the thin strip of land which runs along the coast.
Also very, very, very tough experience, but we hope that they will abide by the law.
Israel's ambassador to the US goes on TV to explain how it would work for the settlers, many of whom threatened to resist evacuation.
And hopefully most of them will go out. If there are some who will not, we'll have to just to take them one by one in a compassionate way, in a patient way, but hopefully not in a forceful way.
Gaza's a headache for the Israeli government, and the cost of protecting the settlers there is too high, both financially and in soldiers' lives lost. Sharon feels he needs to make some form of concession when the Americans are pressing for political progress. And if Gaza could somehow be separated off, it will ensure a Jewish majority in Israel and the West Bank taken together, which Sharon will be left in overall charge of. And what does Netanyahu think about this? Well, it's not his main preoccupation. Given his stance on conceding anything to the Palestinians, that might seem surprising. But actually, his focus right now is on his career. At this point, he's finance minister.
He ran a very strong budgetary tight policy.
Haaretz editor Alof Ben.
Which saved Israel from the economic catastrophe of the Second Intifada and the collapse of the dot-com boom. And he was then very popular with the business elite. Sharon gave him pretty much a free hand on the economy.
Netanyahu's good at being a free enterprise finance minister, and he's enjoying himself. He doesn't want to do anything to jeopardize that. So he goes along with Sharon's plan to pull out of Gaza. He votes in favour of it several times.
until he realized that if he ever wants to come back to the leadership of the right wing, he should be against, he should oppose the Gaza disengagement.
Handing over the whole of Gaza to the Palestinians is deeply unpopular with the hardliners. And as their anger grows and their voices get louder, Netanyahu seems to wake up and remember the lesson he learnt from his disastrous Y River memorandum. Never take the right for granted. So he reverses his stance and comes out against the Gaza disengagement plan.
He ditched the coalition and ditched the government a week before the disengagement took place.
According to participants in today's cabinet meeting, Netanyahu arrived late. He said he intended to vote against the Gaza pullout and then put a letter on the table in front of Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. That letter contained his resignation, which takes effect Tuesday. A few hours later, in a news conference, Netanyahu said he could not be a partner to a government that is threatening the security of Israel. Gaza is becoming a base for Islamic terror, he said. Everyone sees this. Hamas is getting stronger and taking credit for what looks like our running away under fire.
In the summer of 2005, I watched the Israeli military forcibly evacuate settlers who wouldn't go voluntarily. One big black bear of a man struggled so fiercely it took seven soldiers to carry him 15 meters to a bus. Women soldiers carried his wife, followed by their tearful children. Netanyahu hasn't been the only member of Likud to resist the disengagement plan. Ehud Olmert was deputy prime minister under Sharon at the time, and he remembers trying to get the plan past the party members who opposed it.
We had a vote inside Likud prior to the disengagement, and Sharon and I and the others, we lost the vote, the popular vote in Likud for the disengagement.
Even though his own party rank and file voted against it, Sharon and Olmert had pushed ahead and got the disengagement plan through the Knesset. But now Likud's divided.
So we knew that we are going to get stuck in a very right-wing, extreme, messianic party, and we didn't want to be part of it. We thought that there is a large enough body politics in the center, which could win the elections. And we decided that we want to separate ourselves from the extreme right. And we knew that Bibi will stay there.
Sharon now takes the momentous step of breaking with Likud and forming a new party with his closest allies. They call the party Kadima. Netanyahu sticks to Likud and the hardliners.
I'll tell you something. Netanyahu couldn't change, is not changing, and will never change because there is nothing inside there that can change. There is only one thing which is of consequence and of significance as far as Netanyahu is concerned. Himself, his career. He doesn't give a damn about anything.
This break within Likud has its upsides as far as Netanyahu's concerned. It provides an opening for a new leader, and he's there to step into the breach. Now he's the head of the opposition again, but it's a party that's lost its way, and he takes Likud into an election that is nothing short of catastrophic.
Likud was seen as a relic of the past.
As for its leader,
it was seen as a has-been, with very little future. People thought that it was over for him.
Benjamin Netanyahu's had a taste of power, and under his leadership, the Oslo Accords are on life support. He's learned important lessons about who he needs to court if he wants to win elections. And although he and his party look all washed up, there's one thing he'll prove he's the master of, the comeback. In episode 2 of The State of Netanyahu, The Prime Minister triumphs at home, but abroad, someone's making life difficult.
The United States believes the Palestinian people must have the right to govern themselves.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Slow Newscast. If you enjoyed it, please do rate us or leave a review. The State of Netanyahu was reported by me, Donald McIntyre, and written by me and Chloe Hadjimatheu. It was produced by Chloe Hadjimatheu, sound designed by Hannah Varrell. The executive producer of the Slow Newscast is Matt Russell. The editor was Jasper Corbett.
Hello, it's Tomini from Tortoise. This podcast is sponsored by EY. Senior business leaders in the UK are keen to harness AI, but there's a complex regulatory maze emerging globally. The OECD, a group of the world's richest countries, which includes the UK, has adopted a new set of principles to ensure that AI operates in a way that's safe, fair, and trustworthy. The principles are wide-ranging, but in essence, call for AI systems to be designed in a way that respects the rule of law and human rights, and says there should be transparency around their use. By embracing the core principles of responsible innovation, UK business leaders can better explore sector-specific opportunities and emerging trends without compromising on citizens' trust. Find out more at ey.ai.
That's a sort of freedom, like an intrinsic knowledge, like you are part ocean, ocean is part you. You have salt water in your body. You are part of this.
Oceans, life underwater. A new podcast all about the oceans and the mind-blowing life within them.
Subscribe now to Oceans, Life Underwater on your favorite podcast app.